You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Neil Williams, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Neil Williams. And we hope to have our special guest come on any time now. There he is. Okay.
All right. Just like that.
And just like that. Well, you know, our show covers a lot of topics as it relates to the field of recovery from substance use disorders. And one of the things that we like to do today is a very tough aspect of the recovery business, and that is sometimes we encounter death in recovery. And so what we want to do today is I want to get some perspectives on some things you've experienced, things that you've seen, and folks that maybe have died in an untimely way as it relates to their addiction. So Neil, what
are you asking me? I'm sorry, my thing. No. Hang on real fast.
It's okay.
Are you asking me from my perspective? My connection keeps cutting out.
You start? Yeah, start with about untimely deaths, and death is part of recovery.
Yeah. When I was in my addiction, it was very much a part of life, especially with the drugs that I was using. You know, the harder drugs like heroin, and when you get into some heavy narcotics, it's kind of just a part of the deal. You just expect people, you expect things like that to happen. And in fact, you kind of just are waiting for the day, at least where I was waiting for the day for it to be me. And so when I got into this lifestyle of recovery and things are way different, I think it was a little bit naive, but I guess I just didn't think that it was going to carry over. You feel like sometimes it's something that you left behind with all the other mess. Like you leave all the violence behind, you leave all the crime behind, you leave all the fiending, the stealing and all that behind. And so naturally you're just like, well, that's there too. But, you know, for me in recovery, my first or second year in recovery, I lost someone close to me. Then a year later, another person close to me. And in fact, in the second year, I lost two people. And so I think sometimes people don't realize that never stops. This people are still going to be losing their life. And that's just the nature of the beast. So we consider ourselves the fortunate ones that we're still here. But there are certain things about life that don't just go away. You know, it remains a reality.
That's so true. So, so Brennan, introduce yourself to our listeners and viewers, and tell us a little bit about your experience and kind of where you're at with things, and maybe some of the folks that you've encountered.
Yes, sir. Yeah, appreciate it. Yeah, so like I said, my name's Brandon. You know, the first thing that comes to mind on this topic, right, being in and out of sober living, you know, sober living programs, rehab programs, most of my adult life, you know, you always hear people say, you know, you're going to die if you go back out. You know, you may not have another relapse in you. You know, that's something that we're constantly told. And I think it's, you know, the first time, I remember I was 19, first time being in a program, someone was in a program with this guy, you really.
We got the old Dumas connection going.
Being a younger guy, we think that can happen to us. We can happen to other people. It can happen to
I think we're losing him. You're muted.
You may want to try your hotspot on your phone and log in again using the hotspot on your phone. It sounds like your Wi-Fi is not doing too good down there.
He froze up on mine.
Yeah, he's frozen on mine too. So
let's give I talked to Brennan before this just to make sure this was cool with him. We're in an anonymous program, but Brennan and I both talked about this. Brennan is one of my sponsees, and Brennan's been doing just awesome. He's been in this sober living environment, doing the deal, sticking with it. And Brennan has a unique perspective on this topic because someone close to him actually was one of these folks who lost their life. And I think Brennan, hopefully we can get him back on here to talk about it. There's something about, there is nothing like having to stick. I don't even know how to, it's difficult for me to put it into words, because when you're working this program of recovery and you're new in your sobriety and recovery, it's just some days it's just like going through the motions and I know I have to do this. I know I have to do that. I know I have to do this. And you just like get robotic sometimes. And then when a wrench gets thrown in the spokes like this, because another thing that's important is this individual is pretty close with Brennan. And so when you have a relationship like that, you know how people talk about, surely, you know, folks who have been in the military, who have been in combat together, and they talk about that bond that's forged, you know, and I'm by no means saying that this is the equivalent of that, but it's very similar to that when you're in recovery together and you're going through that stuff because you're dealing with some heavy realities. You get real close with people, and you usually find one or two guys that you just spend the majority of your time with. And when all of a sudden one of those folks is no longer with you, it can be pretty heavy.
How many times have you heard in a meeting about jails, institutions, and death? There you go.
Oh, dude, it's every meeting.
Yeah.
Every meeting.
Jails, institutions, and death, and focusing on the death part. So hopefully it looks like a better connection there, Brennan. Are you on your phone this time?
No, I just switched Wi-Fi, but yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I just gave them some background. I let them know that you and I are working together in the program. Yeah. I let them know that we talked about it beforehand. So I've been sponsoring you, and I let them know that you're going through the steps, doing the deal, and gave them briefed them a little bit on your friend. So if you want to kind of tell everybody more about your experience with what we're talking about today.
Yeah. Did it cut me out right from the jump last time, or when did it cut me off?
We heard you talking about how you are kind of just waiting for you to be the person you always hear that people may lose their life and that stuff happens. And that's pretty much all we got.
Okay. Yeah, no, I mean, something that you were just talking about that I definitely relate to, you know, talking about the bonds you form with guys in these type of, you know, any type of sober living or rehab deals. You know, it's like you can know someone for, you know, in a 3-month program, and it's like the equivalent to 2 or 3 years of someone that, you know, just, you know, an acquaintance that you meet, you know, at work or at church or another deal like that, just because of the amount of time and stuff you go through with those people. But yeah, as you mentioned, I had a guy, you know, we came into the program together. I got here one day, he came in the next day, and, you know, we were around the same age in a program where most everyone was older and stuff like that. We kind of had similar backgrounds and got real close, you know, and, I got to see him make a lot of those same mistakes that I typically make, you know. And just watch his kind of relapse process start, and eventually, which led to his death, you know. And it's hard to process that, you know. It makes everything super real when something like that happens, you know. Because it's one thing to go to meetings, you know, we hear about it all the time, you know, people, you know, you can die, you know, some people don't have another relapse in them, but when you see someone close like that to you die, it's an eye-opening thing for sure. You're definitely, I think as addicts, we feel like we have a certain level of invincibility, and seeing that is just kind of eye-opening, you know.
Yeah,
especially when you're doing stuff like the stuff you and I got into. I know that some people pride themselves on the amount of their habit, you know, like, right, oh, I can do this kind of shot, or yeah, I need this much per day. And, you know, it just becomes such a casual thing. And that's a lot of times what ends up taking people out, is that the sheer volume of the substance. And not really, it's a weird thing to say, but I always try to tell guys, like, you don't have to like the drug. In fact, I want you to hate it, but you better respect it, because that thing's a lot stronger than us. We're human beings. There's no personality to the drug. There's no depth to the drug. It just is what it is, and it is poison, and it ain't doing nothing for anybody but killing people. We lose respect for it.
Yeah, I think, and you know, I've said this, I've made this comment before, I've made it after, you know, my friend had passed. It's not to say that you can, you know, necessarily put your finger on a specific trend and why that happens, or a certain, I don't know, demographic where that's more prevalent than another. But in my experience, what I've seen in my, you know, short adult life in recovery, is that to me, it seems like the people who are almost more vulnerable to overdoses, right, are people exactly like me, you know, come from a decent family, have a lot of stuff going on, have a lot of good sides to their personality, right, and then just have these issues, and it manifests itself in an extreme way of using drugs or alcohol, right? And it seems like those people are almost more vulnerable to overdoses or to, you know, death and addiction than kind of your serial alcoholic or your serial meth head who's, you know, their families use, you know, their parents use drugs, their parents' parents use drugs, their parents' parents, you know, they come from a long line of addiction and just, you know, kind of criminal activity. It seems like, you know, if I were to relapse and go back to the dope house, those guys would still be there, you know. And it's I feel like a lot of times the young people who just can't really understand how serious the disease is, or how serious or how far their addictions progressed, are the ones that to me are more vulnerable of an overdose. And again, that, you know, that may not be a fact. That's just what I've seen through my experience for sure.
Yeah. Bruce, I'm curious what you have to say about that, because you've been working in this industry for a long time, and so you've seen a lot of this.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and now that I'm older and see it through not just a therapist eye or a worker's eye, but now kind of, you know, as a parent, you know, as a grown adult, you know, that has kids, and when you see this, you know, when you see that happen, it's just, you know, it's heartbreaking, and it is real. It's part of this business, you know. You know, relapse is part of this business. When we start our call a few minutes ago, I was talking about something that happened, you know, with some other folks, you know. So it's just something that, you know, it's there. It's always around the corner, you know. And just like Brendan was saying, well, actually you were saying, Neil, or both of you guys were saying, you know, having a respect for alcohol, respect for the drugs, what it can do, you know, that invincibility, and you think it'll never happen, or you have a long run or a long runway before you get into something like that, man, it can just be, you know, that fast, you know, and that's your last day on earth. So, yet again, you know, this, you know, situation, I know that Brennan, you know, experienced, you know, must have been tough. And Brennan, I don't want to put you on blast, but you actually had to, didn't you have to go with another guy from your recovery team and pick up the guy's stuff and stuff?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, I was asked by the program director of the program that I'm in to, you know, he was from another part of the state, and, you know, he had passed away in this motel room, and me and another guy were asked to go collect his stuff so that they could ship it back to his family. And at first, you know, this is a couple days after it had happened, or since I found out that it happened. And, you know, at first I'm like, man, that's tough. I don't even want to, I mean, it's hard enough knowing that I lost one of my best buds. But I felt like going to do that, it was almost like me doing one last favor for my friend. And not only that, but it, you know, it just helped the reality to set in, right? Like, I'm holding the man's phone that, you know, I'd seen him on, you know, borrowed his phone when I first got to the program, when I didn't have a phone, fresh out of jail, I borrowed his phone, and now I'm holding his phone and he's not there. That in a way, you know, it helped things set in for me, just how real it is, you know, just how real it is. In no way do I think that, that my friend thought that he was, I mean, if you would have told this guy, hey, you know, you're in your last month here on earth, a month ago, he would have laughed in your face. Even after he had relapsed, he would have laughed in your face. And I'm confident of that. And so that just, to me, that just made everything super real. You know, it really set in doing that. It was a hard thing to do, but, you know, I think that, you know, there's always a lesson to be learned from everything, right? It can be kind of morbid to say in a situation like this, but I feel like, especially with his specific story, it can help a lot of people who are going through this. You know, a lot of young people, especially alcoholics, we can rationalize why we can use alcohol in our head, right? After certain periods of clean time or sober success, or, you know, lack of, I don't know, 20 years, 10, 15 years in addiction, we can kind of, if you read the big book and see, get a glimpse at the addict mind, you can see that we convince ourselves to do those things. That's not uncommon. And then, you know, what happened to my friend shows where that takes us. You know, they, everyone says this saying, you know, it's a common saying, play the tape forward. And to me, that was watching the tape. I got to watch that tape be played forward. And that's something I know I won't forget. And hopefully in helping people in the future, that's going to be something that, you know, his story is going to be something that I'm going to use to try and reach people just like us. So, and, you know, who knows, maybe that reaches someone, maybe that resonates with someone, so that, you know, even a tragic thing like this, a senseless death, a tragic death can hopefully help somebody else, you know?
Yeah. And I think with alcohol, we live in a society where it's not only very accepted, it's promoted. It's wildly promoted. Like, athletes on alcohol ads is one of the funniest things ever to me. It's the most ridiculous thing ever. Let's take the healthiest human beings and use it to promote what easily kills people. But say you've got this, and I don't think a lot of us recognize like how deadly alcohol is. And right. I even have a guy right now who, he was in recovery and now he's drinking, and he was explaining to me just this weekend, like, yeah, but I'm just drinking. Like, I'm not doing drugs. I'm just drinking. And, you know, there's a lot of things to that. Like, one, there's the saying that the dope pipe's just at the bottom of my liquor bottle. you know, because once you start using, once you start drinking again, it won't be too long before you're doing the other things. And history shows that. The other thing is alcohol's safer. No, it's not. Like, no, it's not. Sure, you can use less heroin. You can die from less heroin than you can alcohol, but the fact remains both can kill you. So I think that's a lot of it too. Like you're saying, is that we just sometimes are like, yeah, but you know, I'll be careful, or I'll drink moderately or whatever, you know, and then before you know it, you're off and running.
Yeah. You said it's okay if I jump in. Yeah, no. So you said it's like promoted in our society today. I'd almost even go a step further, and certainly it almost feels like it's required in some aspects, like in social settings, especially as a young person, you know, social settings, everything like that. It almost feels as, you know, you're living with a handicap in some sort of a way, not being able to have that. And again,
like college and stuff like that.
Exactly. For a young person in recovery, that in a way is like a handicap. But I mean, you were mentioning a guy who said he was in recovery and now he's just drinking. Look, I've been that guy. Every one of my relapses is always without fail, always started with alcohol, right? And I mean, you know, I'm thinking of this last relapse. I mean, I made it almost a year just drinking. You know, but the flaw in that thinking is that to say that we can just drink, that we have a drug problem, we can just drink, is to deny the fact that we're an addict in the first place, because we don't use substance moderately. We don't use any type of substance moderately. You know, for me, it started out, I just started drinking once a week, and it was twice a week. Then it was on, you know, weekends, and it's on weekdays, and then it was just beer, and it's never going to work. If you're an addict, it'll never work. And it may take some people, it takes a couple of hours to get back to the dope pipe. Some it takes years, but you'll get back there if that's your issue, you know. Right. So yeah,
you're absolutely right. Bruce, were you going to say something?
Yeah, the thing about alcohol, and if it's a person that has a high tolerance for alcohol, like a lot of alcoholics have a big time tolerance. And so just like Brennan was saying, you know, more than likely that guy, he wasn't suicidal. He wasn't suicidal at the time, but he drank so much so fast that he was a dead man walking. In other words, that's it. You know what I mean? That tolerance allows you to drink copious amounts, but you know, you stay at it long enough and hard enough for that episode, you'll overdrink and that's it. You're dead. So anyway, that's the interesting thing about alcohol.
Yeah, I think, and the other thing I remember for me was how I felt. Like, I didn't feel like I was in that bad a shape. In fact, the first time I went to treatment when I was 19, this was right after I had, you know, had a suicide attempt, and going into treatment, like, I remember how I felt. And I lied to the treatment facility. I didn't tell them how much I was taking and how much I was using. And the second day in treatment, I had a seizure hit my head in the park. Like, my body just quit on me. Now, like, I felt like I would just be fine going through that. But clearly I was not okay. So my body was just ready to shut down. And that's exactly what it did. But I think a lot of us have that misconception, like, you're going to feel it coming on, or you're going to know, like, no, you're not. You're an alcoholic. You're an addict. Like, you cannot tell the difference between feeling healthy and unhealthy, because you've been living unhealthy In fact, you've been living more unhealthy than most people ever will. So that's a misconception for sure.
Well said, yeah. For sure.
Having some technical issues over here. So I gotta get some things in better shape here. Anyway, well, how, you know, is death a deterrent? I mean, do you guys see death as a deterrent and that helps your recovery, or it's just an occupational hazard?
Well, that's a good question because, well, let me ask you, Brennan, let me ask you this question. Have you, because I've seen it go both ways. I've seen somebody experience loss of a loved one or someone close to them and it trigger a relapse. And then I've seen people like in your situation where you lose someone and you learn from it. And it actually, I don't want to say it like elevates your level of recovery, but it certainly motivated you to invest more into your recovery, did it not?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. As far as that's a really good question, actually. Is death a deterrent? I think, certainly speaking on my past, right? I don't think that death has ever been a real deterrent keeping me from using or wanting to get help. I don't think the fear of my life was ever what caused me to want to get help or stop using. And I think even going forward, although I can learn from this, I don't by any means think that would be enough to keep me sober. I don't think it scares me straight. You know what I'm saying? I think it may, you know, being still fresh, it definitely, like you said, it's motivated me to, hey, this stuff's for real. I need to take this seriously. Maybe, invest in myself a little bit more than I'm already doing, you know, because of this, I'm more tender to some stuff, more open to some stuff because of it. But as far as it being an overall deterrent, I really can't say that it has been that I think would be. You know, when that relapse process starts, whatever gets us there, I think that the only thing that keeps us from going back to that is just a desire in ourselves to not want that life anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like, jail, consequences, overdose. I really don't think, I'm just speaking for myself and what I've seen in people close to me in recovery, that's never you'd think that it was, right? For a non-addict here, and that they'd be like, oh my gosh, like, you've been to the hospital X amount of times, jail X amount of times, like, don't you want to live, you know? But I think, speaking for myself, with someone with an addict mind, I don't think that's a significant, certainly not significant enough of a deterrent. That's my thoughts on it.
No, I agree, because the time that I just mentioned where I went into treatment and my heart stopped for 8 minutes, you know, I should have brain damage. I should have died. And I mean, I should not be here. 3 weeks later, I convinced my family to sign me out and take me home because I was better. And I got high that night. Like, I got high as soon as I was back in the Metroplex and could make a phone call and get from point A to point B. I had some pills in my hand and I was hitting a bong. Like, I was good. Like, that was all I was thinking about, was taking a couple four bars and hitting the bong, because once I did that, I knew how I would feel. And so I was only focused on getting that feeling, because that was the release that I had been obsessing about. But it reminds me of, the two parts to it. One, I agree with you. I don't think it's enough. I don't think anything's enough to scare a real addict or alcoholic. Like, you can't scare me. You just can't. You can scare me. You can put the fear of God into me. I've had a pistol in my mouth before. It's pretty scary, right? But what I did after that event was at this, you know, so it scares you, but not from that, because that's your right. solace. That's your go-to. That's your hole. That's where you go to hide. So that's like your safekeeping, at least you think it is. The other part is, for me, recovery, the true essence of recovery is experiencing the miracle that can happen in sobriety. And that's why there's a difference between sobriety and recovery. In sobriety, and when you're working a program of recovery, you're pursuing what we call the obsession being removed. And it's also called a spiritual experience. And my friend Keith, when I volunteered in this treatment facility for about 5 or 6 years, and my friend Keith, I love this guy to death. Keith, this older black dude who, you know, grew up in the hood, and this dude, just the sweetest, kindest guy ever. And he was a program tech at this treatment facility for years, and the guys loved him. And he would always tell them, because this is a state-funded place, so we got a lot of guys on parole, a lot of guys off the street, and they would leave a lot. They'd just get up and say, F you guys, I'm out. And you could do that there. You could walk out the door. And he would always say, don't leave before the miracle happens. He would always tell them, just don't leave before the miracle happens. Because what happens with addicts and alcoholics like us is we're willing to invest a decade plus into making the drug work. Finding a way for this drug to fix what we think it's going to fix. But God forbid we give sobriety 30 fucking days. Like, we can't do that, you know? And that's why people tell you, dude, just give it a shot. And I always, when I'm having an issue with somebody being motivated and I'm working with them, I tell them, I ask them, you know, What was the craziest thing you did? What were the lengths that you went to get your fix? Like, oh, bro, there's a tornado. I walked 4 miles. I stole a bike from an 8-year-old, and I got to the dope house and I got my fix. But you won't walk 0.3 miles to get to an AA meeting. You'll say you just didn't have a ride. Like, you have to put those things side by side and say, why am I willing to go to any length for this? But I can't accept a minor inconvenience for what could be the rest of my life in freedom, happiness, and just sheer elation. But that's the sickness, you know? And it's just scary. It's scary that's one of the hardest parts, is being patient with the process and allowing it to work, because it works.
How do you guys make that transition, you know, from that addict mindset and the guy with the 8-year-old bike and all that other stuff, you know, versus how do you get to the point where you're patient, you understand that the miracle might happen, and you kind of go into living life on life's terms? Like, what are some of the steps that you guys either have experienced yourselves or seen others do so they can get that miracle?
Brendan, you want me to go first? You want to go first?
Do what?
Said that's a thinker.
That is a thinker for sure. It's a super cliche basic answer, but it's really working the steps. I mean, you know, like, in order for that to happen, you gotta work the steps, right? I can't really, I guess it does happen other ways. I sure can't see it happening in my life another way without the steps. You know, I mean, I've tried alternate forms of recovery that exclude the steps and, you know, just trying to do better here and do better there. And I never had that. I never had that, you know, complete psychic change or spiritual experience, whichever side you want to go with. I never had that. And until I just humbled my, I think it's you know, the steps requires that you, you know, be humble, you know, and being humble was put to me, the program director here puts it to me as being humble is seeking advice and taking, seek advice and taking, right? That's, and when, cause that's not what we do as addicts. We don't take advice. You know, the big book calls us terminally unique. We feel like we're terminally unique. You know, yeah. Nobody wants to work the steps. That's for all the addicts. We're like, that's different for me. I'm a different type of addict. Well, the big book's got an answer for that too. You know? And so I think when we can finally be like, shit, all right, wave the white flag. Like, this is what's getting people clean. I'm seeing it work. I'm going to give this a shot, right? You got to be at that point. I mean, I don't really like the term rock bottom. I don't think there's ever an end to rock bottom. Your rock bottom can always be worse.
Yeah.
But you got to get to that point where it's like, you know, it, within yourself, you have the desire to not just to want to change. I've wanted to change before and not done anything to change. You know, you got to be, I think the key word is willingness, right? Willingness, right. Sacrifice. You know what I'm saying? What are you willing to do? Just like Neil was talking about. You know, we're willing to do all kinds of crazy stuff, you know, in our addiction. I think that the most dangerous thing, that kind of even ties back into the topic at hand with deaths, is the scary thing is what we can rationalize our heads to do, what we can rationalize our brains to do. You know, I can, you know, my buddy, to use him as an example, and we had talked about this before, but, you know, this was one of the biggest things he struggled with was rationalizing stuff. You know, the guy could rationalize that anything was going to be okay for him, you know. And so, you know, I feel like when we leave ourselves vulnerable to that, when we're not checking that, when we're not putting stuff every day in place, like the big book says, to counter that, that's when we become really vulnerable to a danger spot that can ultimately take us to those, you know, dark places and even take our life possibly. But I think the biggest thing is just is willingness, man. That's the big stars around the word willingness is, you know, when you start being actually willing to do those things, that's when some of those doors to spiritual experiences and psychic changes start happening. At least that's my experience. What do you think, Neil?
Yeah, and the willingness and then taking action. That's why I think – that's why I personally like the 12 steps. That was one of the things that I liked more about it than anything, because for me, I understand work. I understand getting things done. You have to do something. And so when someone said, it's a spiritual program, I was like, yeah, okay. And they were like, it's a program of action. I was like, I can mess with that. I can do that. A program of action makes sense to me. And you absolutely have to do the work. And everyone who says the 12 steps don't work for me probably haven't worked the 12 steps.
Right.
Or they've done, what does it say? Half measures avail us nothing.
Right.
And people are like, no, I did the 12 steps. Did you sponsor anybody? No, I didn't get there. Weird, because that's part of the 12 steps, but okay, I mean, keep talking, you know. So these people who say it doesn't work, terminally unique. And so once you start, for me, the transition, because that was the question, right, was where does the transition happen, and like how do you convince yourself to stick around if you're truly doing the work and you're truly working the 12 steps? You're going to have things happen that you're supposed to grab hold of. So God will show up. Like when I worked my fourth and fifth step, I felt a sense of freedom. I felt things be lifted off. I felt relief for the first time. And I actually felt good about something naturally without smoking something, snorting something, or whatever. Like, and that was something for me to build off of. Like, there, I have something that gave me a little bit of hope to go further and do 6, 7, and 8. And then when you do 6, 7, and 8, and then you do step 9 and you're making amends to people. And when that happened, I felt and experienced even more freedom. And then so I kept going. And then I got 10, 11, and 12. When I got to 12 and I started working with other guys and I started taking them through the steps, the level of freedom I experienced in that was enough for me to never look back. And now we're several years into a whole new life, and I can't imagine it any other way. So like Brennan said, you got to be willing to see it through, to give it an opportunity. And you got to be willing to humble yourself, like Brennan said as well. You just have to. And but that brings us to the scary, unfortunate, ultimate truth of addiction to alcoholism is some people just never get there. And some people just are not willing. And some people just are convinced that it's not for them. And for those folks, I hope they find something that works before, you know, time runs out. Because time does run out.
Yeah,
it does. You want to, Brennan, you want to do a little snapshot of Five Alive?
Yeah, I will. I'll go into that. Right before that, I was, you know, when that mob, when Neil was talking about it, reminded me of something. When that moment happened for me, not that it was the end all be all, I haven't finished working steps, right? But when that first kind of significant, I mean, really significant moment happened for me, look, it was New Year's Eve, right? The hardest day of the year to stay sober for me. I mean, maybe it shouldn't be. It is nonetheless, right? And of all days to do a fifth step, that was the day that I did my fifth step with Neil. You know, I didn't feel like doing my fifth step. I was having cravings right then. And, you know, I did that fifth step, you know, in the evening on New Year's Eve. You know, I'm looking on my social media and everything. Everyone I know was out having what seems to be an amazing time. And here I am in a halfway house in my room alone doing my fifth step. You know, I'm on the phone with Neil, I'm a sponsor, doing the fifth step. And it's like I finished it. And it's like after I finished, it sounds cliche, but after I finished that, like shit just became real for me. It was like, dude, I'm really doing this. Like I'm really doing this, you know, I had these feelings. I'm working the steps like they're designed. I called my sponsor. I did this fifth step. And now I feel this, man, that gave me a huge boost of confidence moving into the new year. So that mixed with, as you just brought up, the Five Alive is, man, that, you know, experiences like that and the Five Alive go hand in hand right now. As most addicts do, I struggle with daily disciplines. Right. So Neil's got me on this program that I mostly do good at of sending him a little accountability message every day after I do my daily readings, which, you know, I think we need that, right? We need that. Even, you know, I can see myself doing that a year down the road from now. You know, it's just, I think that's something that's just good for us. It's real easy to backslide. We can all backslide, rationalize stuff that makes it easier not to. Look, the Five Alive or something that was introduced to me by this program, and now it's called, you know, it's read, write, pray, call, and meet. Do at least three out of those five things, you'll stay sober. Do five of them, you'll have, it'll revolutionize your life, right?
That's every day, right?
Every day, yeah. No, I don't do all five every day. I'm going to come out and say that, but I do most of those every day. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. I'm going to read something every day. I'm going to write some stuff down every day. You know what I'm saying? A lot of times, you know, Neil, we have some form of communication, whether it's a text or, you know what I'm saying? There's some communication with the sponsor. I'm hitting at least one to two meetings a day. And that's how I've done it. You know what I'm saying? I have to have that to stay sober. You know, at least right now, I don't know what it'll be like years down the road, but I know right now I have to have this. I got to go to a meeting. I got to have some form of contact with another person about recovery, whether it's with you, Neil, my sponsor, or whether it's with one of the other guys here or a new person in the program. I got to have some type of conversation about recovery at least once a day. You know what I'm saying? I got, you know, and I think that works. That you know, incorporating that into your daily routine is a good way to do, to not do what I was just talking about, which is rationalizing stuff, believing the lies that we tell ourselves, you know, feeling sorry for ourselves, you know, peer pressure. It combats all those things that are typically major relapse triggers. If we can put that boom in the start of our day, you know, I don't know. It's just like anything else. It's like training for a sport or anything like that. I know that everyone uses those analogies, but that's really what it is. It's really what it is. You know?
Yeah. When I'm 8 years into this thing, my sponsor texts me every night. Like we do this, and it's not like militant. It's what we like to do. And the text he sends me is these 10 step questions. You know, do I have a resentment? Do I owe an apology? What have I done to get back to the stream of life? Is there something I need to discuss? And how much of today, percentage wise, did I contribute towards others, and how much was for self? So every day I'm looking at 30% was about me and 70% was about others, or vice versa, right? And it keeps me in check. That's because you never stop working the steps. 10, 11, and 12 are, you know, the maintenance steps, I think is what they call them, or maybe I'm wrong. But it's your living. You're supposed to be living this way, and it's continual inventory, looking for ways to improve and practice these principles in all our affairs, and then carrying the message, so helping others. And dang it, what was it? Something you said. Oh, yeah. The other thing is, this is supposed to be fun. Like every Monday night, I go have dinner, and I'm going to do it tonight. I'm going to go have dinner with two guys that are other professionals in the industry, and they're also like me. They're in recovery. We go have dinner, and then we go to a meeting afterwards, and we're friends. So we're going to hang out, but this is also something we all three know we have to do. And so you have to find a way to make this. It's not miserable. This is not a death sentence. This is a reward. This is a new way of life. And you just have to understand. It's just like having a great job. You can love your job. Your ass better get to work, though. Like, you know, be grateful for the career, but you better work. And that's recovery, man. And I couldn't be happier. I've never done a fifth step on New Year's Eve until this one, and I thought that was just the funniest thing ever because it wasn't planned. It's just where we ended up, you know? And you have no idea what that does for me. Like, that does a lot for me. So thank you for that. You know, I appreciate that.
Yeah. It's a lifestyle, you know, it's like what you're saying. It's not 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and you're done. It's a lifestyle, like you said, and we should enjoy it, you know? I think if our heart and head's right with it, we will enjoy it, you know?
So, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, then. Well, that's a wrap, man. That went by real quick. It says a lot about both you guys, not just one or the other, but both of you guys doing that on New Year's Eve. That's just so awesome to hear and so inspiring, man. So on a lot of levels. But, well, Bryn, thanks for coming on the show today. We'll have to have you come back again and give us an update. Right. It's always fun to hear from folks that are right in the trenches with things, you know, and right there in those good stages. So thanks for coming on the show. And
glad absolutely. Thank you guys for having me, for sure.
Yeah.
Heck yeah, man.
All right, Neil. So we're – okay, there he goes.
He just drops.
He did something up. all right.
It's a cold world.
I tell you. How can folks find us, and how can folks find you?
Concierge_coaches on Instagram, and then we have the Concierge Coaches Show on Facebook, and we are on Apple Apple Podcasts and then iHeartRadio, right?
Yes, sir.
And then you can find me at Elevated Lifestyle Academy on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, and my website is elevatedlifestyleacademy.com. Bruce, where can they find you?
At conciergecoach.net and on Facebook. So let's see what we have here.
Amazon Music. Oh, wow. I didn't even know.
Our producer says Amazon Stitcher. No, Amazon Music and Stitcher. And yes, we did mention iHeartRadio. Thank you, Ronan.
He's team. On it today.
Man. Man, we're a team today. Love it like when you're a team. Thank you so much, sir. Appreciate it. Well, folks, thanks for tuning in and listening and catch this show and other past shows. And we're going to have some fun future shows here coming up here in the near future. So with that, we'll bid everybody a great week. Stay safe, stay healthy. And we'll see you here next time on the Concierge Coaches Show on LA Talk Radio. Take care, everybody.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Neil Williams, only on LA Talk Radio.